Hi, welcome to valuationpodcast.com, a podcast and video series about all things related to business and valuation. My name is Melissa Gregg, and I'm a divorce valuation and mediation expert in St. Louis, Missouri. I have the pleasure of discussing today a fabulous book called The Forensic Accounting Desk Book with my guest, Miles Mason, a divorce lawyer in Memphis, Tennessee. So he's actually written this book, The Forensic Accounting Desk Book, and it's a practical guide to financial investigation and analysis for family lawyers. But I also think it's a really important resource for business valuation experts. Welcome, Miles. How are you?
Doing great.
Awesome. So let's just start off easy. How can financial experts even help attorneys or be of assistance to family lawyers in a divorce?
Yeah, great question. It's, I think, apparent and axiomatic for most lawyers to understand when they need a forensic accountant. The question is, how does a lawyer sell the client on spending extra money? And so I've got a few tips on how to do that. First, explain to clients that forensic accountants can go through discovery faster and often less expensive. One of the things that I do believe is that every piece of paper, every document in a divorce needs to be reviewed. And it could be 1 second. It could be 1 hour looking at a page. And forensic accountants can perform that function, sometimes less expensive, because they know what they're looking at. Second, forensic accountants can testify. As the divorce lawyer, I can't testify. So if I see something in a tax return, I can't tell the judge what that item means. I've got to have an expert. Third, the magic behind expert witness testimony is very simple. They can rely on hearsay to form opinions. And many times, a lot of the documents in a divorce are chock full of hearsay, double hearsay, triple hearsay, and or the parties may not have created them. So you solve a lot of evidentiary issues with just having an expert. You can get tax returns, bank statements, canceled checks, check images into evidence through your forensic accountant. Now, also, one of the things I really love is that forensic accountants can be perceived by the judge or the trier of fact as independent and unbiased. Okay. So when you've got a client who's going to walk in and say, look, I only spend $30 a month on something related to work. Okay. The judge is going to look at it and say, what do you mean you only spend $30? Okay. Reverse that. Well, I spend $600 a month on hair care. Okay. There are some people that do. But what the forensic accountant can do is say, I've looked at the numbers for the last 24 months prior to the filing of the divorce, and my client spent $595 a month on average on hair care. Okay, well, that establishes lifestyle, and that testimony is a lot more credible and perceived to be less biased than the person themselves. Okay. Forensic accountants can smell problems. They know, and this is just really kind of magic, and every time I get a chance to speak to forensic accountants, I try to tell them, nobody can do what we do. You can look at a tax return. You can look at a personal financial statement. You can look at the documents submitted in a divorce and tell if there's a problem. Okay? If there's a massive estate, over $5 million, may not be massive, and there's no tax return over $110,000 ever, well, you're going to ask a few questions. Obviously, somebody's figured out something, okay? So forensic accountants know just by looking at the paperwork when certain items don't add up. And then finally, the most beneficial use of a forensic accountant is very simple. When I'm negotiating a settlement and I've got my client in a room where, let's say we're at mediation, and the other side knows I have a forensic accountant in the room with me negotiating this, it does alter the relative negotiating position of the parties, meaning the other side's going to feel that we have an advantage. Whether we have an advantage or not, these little perceived advantages add up over time and encourages the opposing spouse to get real, get serious, and cut the deal that's favorable to our client.
Yeah, I think that a couple other considerations is including the expert on the team. You know, I see a lot of times where an attorney will hire experts, but they kind of keep them at kind of an arm's length position. Like, I don't want you to know too much. I don't want you to know too little. I just enough to do your job. Where in reality, the whole process has a lot of strategy to it. And I think strategizing with the forensic accountant, the business valuation expert, anything, not in contriving numbers, but there's a lot more to this than just the numbers, right? I mean, how do you do discovery? It's when do you do it? When do you do the depositions? All of these types of things. But if you just, and it comes from working with certain experts a couple of times, right? To see how they do things, to see how they review documents and such.
Right. Now, some forensic accountants I can hear when they're watching saying, I don't want to be in the middle of those discussions because I'm a fact witness at that point, mm-hmm. as opposed to an expert witness. Mm-hmm. But it's a divorce. 99 times out of 100, the forensic accountant is not going to end up knowing something that's not going to be in discovery anyway. Mm-hmm. Okay. So even if you throw a couple of ideas at the forensic accountant and they say, well, I don't really like that as an issue compared to another, let's say it does come out in court. Let's say there's an email that gets exchanged between the lawyer and the forensic accountant. The odds are of a decent forensic accountant getting hurt on the stand is very low because opposing counsel says, hey, Mr. Expert, you said you didn't like this issue for advocacy. You're over there helping set up advocacy. He says, no, I'm an advocate for my opinion. I just didn't think that that part of the story means a lot. And gives them 10 minutes to bolster their opinion. So, again, rarely is there some bombshell. And if there is, don't tell the forensic accountant because they're going to testify.
Yeah. But I think you bring up an interesting kind of nuance, right? Because mm-hmm. not everybody understands, first of all, not everybody really understands the whole expert witness process. But then beyond that, we have a difference between a testifying expert and a consulting expert, not just in divorce, but in all types of litigation. And maybe you can give us a little bit of knowledge from an attorney's perspective, like what is that difference and does it matter at all?
It can matter and it has mattered and it might matter or not. And that's why you have to navigate this and understand because one of the things for lawyers who don't understand this, they look like idiots in the courtroom. Okay. An expert witness testimony is the time for where the lawyer should shine. Okay. I don't want to say it's easy, but it's kind of easy to do direct examination of a forensic accountant. And if you got somebody else helping you with the cross-examination of the other expert, you're going to look like a genius. You can't help but not look like a genius if you have some training and understanding what's going on. Now, let's put this together. A consulting expert is one that is not anticipated to testify. And if they're not anticipated to testify, they don't have to be disclosed. All right. So if you want somebody to be a consulting expert, as the lawyer, rule one, make sure in the engagement agreement it says consulting expert only. Okay. And I know that because I've been in court and argued when I had a prior business valuation expert that my client had paid for and paid $30,000 for a BV, and some time passed and we wanted to see it. And we had disclosed this expert as our witness. And the other side, no. It was our witness consulting only. Okay. And I said, okay, where's your engagement agreement that says that? And the other side had no engagement agreement. They probably did, but it probably was a boilerplate. And although I never got the BV, I got my client the $30,000 back, which was almost better because the BV was too old at that point. The divorce had dragged on for quite some time. So you want to dot your I's and cross your T's if you don't want to disclose. And that also applies with forensic psychologists as well. Now, once they testify, I take the position and argue in court that everything that the testifying expert sees, hears, tastes, reads, smells, thinks is discoverable. Now, we've had that recently in one of our cases, and the law may or may not say that in any particular state, but why wouldn't it be that way? And the first stop is, of course, whether it be Missouri or Tennessee, Rule of Civil Procedure 26 is the federal rule that applies and says what information has to be exchanged. Now, one of the subtopics under that, what about email between the expert and the lawyer? Many forensic accountants in seminars say, be careful, you may have to give up your email. I don't know why you wouldn't have to give up your email. But I can tell you, I think the practice nationwide is even if it's subpoenaed, don't give it and make the other side file a specific motion to get the email because they probably won't want to go to that expense, although I like to because I want to see what's in those emails.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest issue as an expert is if you're going to be a consulting expert, that you treat it as if you are a testifying expert, because it is the same. If you convert at any point, so when I come in as a consulting expert, I'm there to look at other reports. I'm there to give some idea to the attorney what to look for, right? Or to talk about strategy of like, you don't have a case, you do have a case, here's the BV, here's the lost profits, whatever. But in the engagement letter, they can convert to a testifying expert. So I tell the clients and the attorney, we're going to operate as if I'm a testifying expert from day one. There will be no email exchange. There will be calls. There will be Zoom here, you know, meetings and things like that, but nothing in writing. I have also had cases where the attorneys have agreed that the emails between the attorney and the expert for both sides, they would not provide. But right. That's an agreement.
And I think that's smart from both sides, because the odds are there's nothing in there that's all that exciting from a substantive standpoint. And whether or not a particular fact is in a forensic accountant's head, the experienced forensic accountant's going to say, well, I discount everything my own client tells me anyway, because I'm an objective, independent witness. And if it's not on a piece of paper that's in the financials, probably not even considering.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that, you know, it's more so clients have a harder time totally understanding this process, or maybe new attorneys, new experts. I've seen that that's where people will kind of be like, can you make the number be 2.5 million? And then they end up in court at 2.6 million or 2.4 million. And they're like, well, but this email said that you, that the attorney asked you to be at 2.5. So you're kind of there. You know, I think that those are the types of things. Or I've tried to say, use email for factual information. Like, you know, tell me the date of something, tell me that something exists, but don't say, oh, we need to try to make this be lower by excluding it.
Right. Sorry. I've got standard deposition questions I ask in every engagement on what did the lawyer say they hope the valuation turn out to be, and what the client wanted the valuation or the testimony to be. Mm-hmm. And I have 6, 7 in the book, different questions coming at it from different angles to ferret that out. And if I get at a deposition, a email or document from the client or the lawyer to the expert that marries up pretty close, I've got great fodder for cross-examination and exhibits for the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, when it comes right down to it, how an expert is most effective and efficient is by supporting their conclusion, which means not from somebody said it's going to be this number or that number, because I've talked to other attorneys and other experts, and guess what? We can see it. We can see when you've contrived a number. We can see where you made an assumption that is completely out of the realm of reasonableness. The problem, though, with that, which I think it would be interesting to get your perspective, is that the nuance of that issue, right? Two experts disagreeing on something where one opinion is just outlandish, mm-hmm. is sometimes lost when it gets to the judge. The judge is like, I mean, I kind of, you know, they have their position. They're smart. And it's like, no, this is wrong. But it's not always as blatant or obvious to the judge, even when we make it blatant and obvious to the judge.
Yeah. And that's the art, mm-hmm. instead of the science. So we all expect some difference. Okay. Whether it be take a small family shop, maybe a manufacturing concern. One expert at 2.4, another expert at 3.6. Okay, well, the judge is going to look at it and say, yeah, it's $1 million. That's worth having a trial over. But geez, you know, I'm going to split the baby on this. It may say that in chambers. Mm-hmm. Okay, but let's assume in the equation that the 3.6 million expert made three key assumptions, put three in the screen, that aren't reasonable whatsoever. So when you walk into a courtroom, the judge already expects you to trash the other expert from the beginning. So how do you put a spotlight on those three assumptions that are outrageous? That's advocacy. Okay. And you may even have to go get a second expert. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But you've got to drill and attack the other expert hard. Mm-hmm. Hard. And that may mean, like I said, having your expert and or another expert come in and say, not only this is wrong, it's arguably fraudulent, Your Honor, and say why. And that's really hard to get other forensic experts to testify that somebody is not just wrong, but dead wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I would never, ever hire an expert to do something like that. To get in that situation, if I can get the other side up from 2.4 million to 3.1 million or even 2.9 million. Mm-hmm. I've earned my feet.
Right.
Okay. So that's always a tough situation. And judges have a hard time getting to the courthouse, much less figuring out between two business valuation experts. And that's why you got to win the beauty contest right off the bat. We can talk about beauty contests later. And you're just going to have to go through, take the time to dismantle the opposition. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, and the best way to dismantle an opponent, an opposing expert, is set it up during the deposition. But when you set it up during the deposition, they know what's coming at trial and have time to massage it, so to speak.
Right.
So it's a great challenge, and that's part of what makes our system magical, in that the system wants a number more than it wants a number to be accurate, if that makes any sense. The number is the thing. How we get the number sometimes isn't nearly as important, because the judge may be an English major or a political science major and have no background whatsoever in balance sheet, ratio analysis, discounted cash flow, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and, you know, like one thing that we don't always talk about is that there are gray areas in valuation. There's the art part as opposed to the science. And that is where a lot of the disagreements come, when it's gray, when you have, you know, even in the valuation community, you have leaders in the community that are saying, you know, opposing viewpoints on the same topic. Well, then you have fodder for each expert to say, well, so-and-so's saying this and so-and-so's saying this. And then the judge is like, now I'm even more confused. But I think that from advice to the expert is that one way to try to prevent that is to have more of your emphasis and your assumptions be in some supportable position. So if you're going to make a growth rate assumption, have another document, a research report that supports it, right?
Right. But in my experience, when we have an outrageous assumption, the good news is those outrageous assumptions are usually not supported. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you've got two top-notch experts and there's a theoretical difference, like, as you were discussing, usually that's going to move the needle some, but not so much that you can't settle around it. Mm-hmm. You know, so the question is, you as a lawyer, we have to say, are we talking about just a difference of opinion, or are we talking about a manipulation? Mm-hmm. And when you can't tell the difference because the effect, the impact on that difference, that's when it gets a little weird. But usually when I see, and my expert tells me, we've got a number here that makes no sense and it's not justified, and there's no reference to any supporting information, well, we're going to have to depose the expert because they wrote a crappy report.
Right.
And that's one of the things that we'll talk about later. Reports that are, and what they're going to do is they're going to, the expert who's using that crappy number is probably relied on some software and may not even know where that number comes from.
That's true. Well,
or is taking an average of A, B, and C, and A, B, and C have no reality,
right?
To the cat, no basis in reality for that particular business.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I have some more opinions, but we'll keep moving. But one of the things that you also said, that, you know, an expert kind of comes at the beginning and looks at the documents. Well, the attorney has to review the documents, the expert reviews the documents. But then there are clearly kind of financial red flags that we're looking for, just to indicate whether, you know, like, it's going to have some impact. And again, we're still referencing, because all of this information is in the forensic accounting desk book. But talk to us a little bit about some of the financial red flags that you're looking for in a divorce.
Right. Well, my point in writing the book, and I was very lucky to have a lot of other forensic accountants help me with coming up with what as you're reading it, appears to be an exhaustive list, 20-something different items. But some of them are so common. Let me go through some of those. So obviously when I get the spouse that has no access to any financial information at all for a decade. So what about username and passwords? What are those? Okay. Right. That's obviously the secretive spouse about financial affairs. Obviously, I always look for unreimbursed business expenses on the tax return, because if there are plenty of spouses out there that say, just give me a check for my reimbursed business expenses, and that's going to go to a separate account. Another fan favorite, so to speak, is the Quicken or QuickBooks program that was on a computer where the hard drive crashed, you know, right before the filing of the divorce. So the hard drive's just gone.
Right.
All right. Now, back in the day, I had a number of hard drives crash on me, but I didn't happen to have the family finances on that computer. So my other favorite, and we can go into even more, but my favorite is when the business owner about to go through a divorce uses for their accounting and tax somebody who's not a CPA. Because if I've got a CPA in charge of records for taxes and or helping the business owner put together a personal financial statement for their credit facility, I know that there's a very low chance that that CPA is going to lie under oath for that particular client. Now, sometimes they may be personal friends and go on business trips together. But if it's a CPA, I'm going to get them a subpoena as early as I can, tell them or remind them of the Arthur Anderson subpoena story and say, don't delete. I'll even come to your office and tell you what we need. Because 99% of the time I can go through a drawer for my client couple hours. We don't need to copy everything. I know I want the depreciation schedules. I want the key tax returns. I want supporting schedules and attachments for the tax returns and any general ledgers, obviously. But the point is the CPA status means so much during a case when we don't have it. I think that in and of itself is a red flag.
Well, and I think that we have, also used emails between the accountant and the parties in some capacity, especially at the beginning when they're like, I think I might get divorced. Can you value the business? Like, this would be great. And could you just make it be, it's not really worth that much anyway. So, but you, it's all me. Like, it's all, I'm the business. Without me, it's worth nothing. But they put it in writing and they put it into that email. And then a lot of times, you know, again, if you don't live and breathe this litigation world, like you just email everything, right? And so they'll email back and, oh, you won't have a problem. You know, we'll get the number low enough. Well, I don't know if I can do it, but somebody from the office will do, you know. And it's fascinating to me because they really just don't always think about the discoverability. Or there are a lot of attorneys though out there that say, well, that communication will be protected. I'll protect it when we get to court. And I love the concept, right? Because I'd love to be able to email willy-nilly, but I don't believe it. And so I protect myself by making sure that none of that communication involves me. But I think that that's, and then a couple other financial red flags that I look for in the tax return is owner's compensation, depreciation, interest expense, rent paid to an affiliated party. Is it fair market rent? You're usually going to look at meals and entertainment, office supplies, and travel or car. You know, if you see a lot of people run their cars through the business, it doesn't make it right or wrong. It just, we're looking for duplicates of whether it's listed as a personal asset and a business asset, a personal expense and a business expense. You know, so not traditionally, we're not looking for fraud when we're going to do the business valuation. But some of those things could be uncovered when you start to look at all the information, right?
Right.
So, but there, and that kind of gets us to some of the financial schemes. And so talk to us a little bit about some of the things that you see. So we see some red flags and then we're like, because I think you have to work backwards, right? You know that something is wrong. And so how do you figure out how it could have been right? Well, you have to first figure out how they could have perpetrated the scheme, right?
Right. And the interesting thing that when I represent clients that are very savvy, shall we say, with financials, it's fascinating because never underestimate the savvy of a long-term business owner because they've got buddies at the country club that's been through it. So let's cover some of the real simple ways and straightforward ways, and then we'll get a little bit more exotic. So you want to reduce your assets. You want to overstate your liabilities. You want to understate your income, and you want to overstate your expenses. Well, guess what document you want, because you're already doing that for that document? Tax return. Okay. So in terms of manipulation of finances, I then look towards who's going to know about it, right? Almost all business owners, especially if they're high flyers, are going to have a financial person somewhere, either in their office or in the accounting, the CPA's office, assisting them. And I want to put that person under oath. Now, in terms of financial lies, trusts are great because trusts pay their own taxes. Okay. Offshore is always very interesting because, and the, my favorite is there's two problems with offshore. One, if you're going offshore to Antigua quite often, that's going to appear on some credit card statements. Okay. Because you got to get on a plane. Or one of my private investigators' favorites was drive to Miami, pay cash for a boat, and take $250,000 in cash with you. All right. But I don't know that many people who want to be in the Caribbean with $250,000 in cash in a duffel bag. Now, there are people who do it, and I've run into them. Okay, I know they've done it because, of course, they brag to their spouse about it before the divorce, which is a whole different topic. But proving it is next to impossible. But point being, I love, you know, people ask me, okay, well, you know how to hide money. Well, yes, I do. The way that I think that works for many businesses is play with a retained earnings account, play with your compensation, for obvious reasons. Putting a boyfriend or girlfriend on a payroll ain't that complicated. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you have to have a fight over the personnel files. You know, I want the personnel file for everybody. What do you mean? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to cross reference it against the payroll log, going to the state for state SUTA and for FICA. Okay, the federal documents. So when you ask for the document that they know they don't have or ain't going to give you, you get that leverage. And the question becomes, what kind of scale are we talking about? Are we talking about millions or are we talking about $100,000? And so early on, you may find this interesting. I'll ask my client, well, you know he's hiding money. Yes. How much are we talking about? Well, I have no idea. I said, is it over $25,000? And I said, oh, no, no. I'm like, oh, do you really want to go?
Right.
Do we really want to go and do a full forensic evaluation for less than $25,000? So lying on financials isn't complicated. especially when we got a whole cash business, and we could spend 6 hours talking about cash businesses, what to do with cash, what people mostly do with cash, and how cash business owners screw up and fail. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about how the best ways to do it for cash business owners. And that is, A, don't get married in the first place, and B, don't spend it. Yeah. Okay. Now, so hopefully that answered your questions. You can get, you know, one of the things I like to tell people is we got to look for, if we take 3 to 5% off of assets, 3 to 5% added to liabilities that may not be legitimate, we add 5 to 10% of expenses and reduce our income by 20%, all of a sudden we could be talking about real money.
Right.
And just keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, I think that when you're considering it, looking in, it does matter how much you're looking at, you know, because, and I try to identify that at the very beginning too, because I don't want to go down a wormhole, because you don't always find what you're looking for. But I also, when I'm working with the business owner and, you know, they're like, well, how should I operate the business? You know, like, not everybody asks that, but they'll be like, well, what should I do while I'm getting divorced? Like, should I keep cash? Should I not keep cash? I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You need to do exactly what you are already doing the best way you can and run your business, because anything you do to defer off of that path, we will know. I will know. The other attorney will know. The other expert, you know, will know. And so realistically, you just need to continue to do what you're doing. You know, sometimes there may be a compensation or something like that, but for the most part, we're not coming in trying to tell them to do something different. I'm usually encouraging them to not do a single thing different, because, you know, if you start stockpiling cash, or let's say you start depleting cash, you know, a lot of times you'll see people go and get more debt. They'll sell things, they'll buy things, and they're like, well, it's within my business, so I can do whatever I want. That doesn't have any, that's not my personal property. Oh, you own the 100% of the business? Well, yeah, but it's not my, that business is its own entity, you know? So I'm like, that's not really how it works. But, you know, so I try to get them to do exactly what they've already been doing. A couple areas though, that get a little confusing when you're looking at the business valuation, it usually, and even if you don't have a business valuation, right? This could just be a high net worth executive. It could be a partial owner of a company, but a very large company, or it could just be anybody that is like CFO, CEO, vice president, something like that. You're going to have complex compensation packages. You're going to have bonuses, stock options, phantom options, RSUs, perquisites, you know, but what else are we looking for in that personnel file that kind of helps us identify some of these assets?
Right. One of the first things you got to understand is that when the divorce lawyer sends a subpoena, there's not one personnel file. There are multiple files. And what we're looking for, in the broadest sense possible, is any kind of indication for any of these complex deals. Specifically, when it comes to incentive programs, and they could be called anything. There's no standard term for them. Often they deal with stock, but can be cash. So what we're looking for is anything that the executive covets. Okay. So whether it be McDonnell Douglas, whether it be Federal Express, there are programs for different levels of management that have objective criteria related to the individual's performance or division or overall performance of the stock. Okay. That has to be written down somewhere, because the whole point of that is to try to lock down these executives so they don't switch companies. So these assets can easily be a large percentage of the net marital estate. Okay. So that's why I preach very aggressive subpoena practice for the different requests. And I want to put possibly for smaller businesses that have incentive programs, I want the business owner under oath. I want the employee under oath. And I want somebody from the business who's not the owner to be under oath. And that might be a 30B6 witness. Maybe it's just a bookkeeper, depending on the size of the business. So, yeah, I think your most important weapon there is perjury, okay? Because it is not uncommon for those for there to be a divorce right before a payout, yeah. Okay? It happens. And it might be the first payout they ever get on a bonus.
Mm-hmm. And there's vesting. I mean, a lot of times there's plan documents or vesting schedules or even statements and summaries. But I guess one area that we kind of crossed over that we could have talked about is that when we're asking for the documents, right, there are things to consider when you're even requesting documents during the discovery process that you'll start to identify some of these issues. And then you may have to do like a secondary process to subpoena other documents. But I think most people know like financial statements and tax returns, but what are some other unique things that you could request or that you're looking for in that discovery process?
Right. I will tell you, pretty much every time I've had a complex compensation package, I didn't get it from the spouse in the first wave. Okay. Oh, that relates to the future. No, it doesn't. Right. It's effective now. Now, so during the discovery process, obviously the tax return is going to give me a lot of information. I talk a lot about the W-2 difference between box one and box five. Mm-hmm. Look at the codes on the back of the W-2. Okay. Now,
or Google them if you don't know what they are.
Right. Yes. Or that's why you need to have a CPA, regardless of how boring they are, as a personal friend to help a pal out with right. reading on the W-2. So the good news is if there's a complex compensation package somewhere, 401k, whatever, usually it's going to be accurately recorded in document. Oh, I want the 12/31 pay stub. If they're on a calendar year, I want that last pay stub.
Right.
And they're going to have those details on there. And if there's a bonus, it probably came out in March or April mm-hmm. of the following year. So I definitely, you know, hopefully that 12/31 statement's going to have that on there as far as payroll. And then I'm going to issue subpoenas. I might issue more than one. So there's a lot of different ways to skin that cat. And anytime, but the key is, like you said, if you don't know what a number means, phone a friend,
right?
You know, get some help.
Well, and sometimes we will have the tax returns, maybe financial statements at the beginning, right? Even the personal tax returns, usually, well, sometimes. And if you have those, I think that more often than not, an attorney will send me some preliminary documents. Like, we at least have these documents, but can you take a look at them and then give us an idea of additional items in discovery that are beyond just the normal regular things that we're going to ask for? And that's when you're looking for some of these items, like, well, this is referencing an account, you know, on their personal statement that is not listed as a current account on their statement of property, things like that.
Right. No question. And then I love subpoenas. I get all warm inside every time we issue one out. Especially when most business owners have a preferred bank, and I just want to find out all the accounts. And it is definitely not unusual that we learn about new accounts in the subpoena versus the response to the request for production of documents.
And it's interesting because, I mean, after you've done this type of work for a while, I think you get just suspicious of why, you know, one side will give you documents or not. And I actually do try to de-escalate the client a little bit in that respect, because I think there's always a possibility of not providing the documents. I also think that when people go through this process, you know, if you have an inexperienced attorney on the other side or expert, or this is the first time getting divorced, they're trying to give you the documents that they think are, you know, and, but they're just erring on the side of caution. And sometimes it's like, well, now not disclosing accounts, I think is different, but not providing, like, I'll get a tax return. And it won't be the whole tax return. It'll just be like, well, I just thought you needed like the first 10 pages or 15 pages. I was like, yeah, but you're aware that I can see that it just basically cut off. Like you didn't have any of the other pieces. And they're like, oh, you need all of that? You know, so I think it's being very clear about what you're looking for, especially if you're on the side of the business owner or the spouse that has all the access, you know, to not let them kind of control the process.
Yes. One of my favorite tactics when I represent the business owner is every 30 days, I'll write a letter to the opposing expert and my opposing counsel saying, let me remind you, we need to get this thing moving. If there's a document you don't have, let me know and we'll get it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after the third letter on that, yeah, that means 90 days, I may file a motion of some sort, set a trial date, cutoff date for the report, blah, blah, blah. And then I know I'm going to get 26 to 28 new punch items, because it's very easy for a CPA to come up with a list of documents that they claim they don't have. But the whole time, at least I can lay the groundwork for proving, hey, we've been offering these documents. There's the brink of insanity, and then there's the abyss about how long they're taking. Don't you dare accuse us of withholding documents, because I'm going to cream you for that. And I go through each one of those letters in deposition on purpose and say, did you respond to this letter 3 months prior to the deadline? No. Did you respond to me at all after the second? No. And so that's really the only way you could prove that you've been cooperative. And most business valuation experts, and I hate to say this out loud, oftentimes don't understand the value drivers in a business. And when they don't understand how a business brings in money in the door, because they're so focused on financial records and general ledgers, they don't key on what's really going on here. Sometimes they don't know the right documents to ask for, right, which becomes a catch-22 for the business owner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think it's really helpful. One of the things that we do for some clients, they might call and say, you know, I don't know if there's value here. I don't know if we should do a full valuation for this. You know, it doesn't seem like it's making much money, things like that. We'll go in and take a look. Or a lot of clients are kind of planning ahead when they get divorced. You know, I mean, it's sad to say, but that's just what they're doing. And so I might get a call from the actual client and they're just saying, well, you know, this has been in the works for a while now, and we'll probably pull the trigger and file for divorce. But, you know, like, what am I looking at? I think that's a really good time to, what we do is we run through all the information. We look and see, you know, like, what are some issues? What do we see as a preliminary value? It also will identify, you know, like recently we had a case where there was a pension that nobody really talked about, and we saw the information, and it was a huge dollar amount, and it was a huge pension. And I was like, why is no, like, your valuation pales in comparison to this issue? And so everybody's looking in the wrong area, you know? So I think in that situation, You know, it's really kind of understanding up front. Now, that's where I think that the attorney kind of including you in some, as an expert, including you in some of that process is helpful, because I could have clearly identified if they, you know, but I was just given the business valuation documents. I wasn't given the whole personal, and that's what sometimes they do, you know, like the attorney will handle all the personal balance sheet and the statement of income and income and expenses or the property statement. And they'll just be like, here's your little segment. You go and do this portion. And sometimes I'm fine with it. You know, like it doesn't bother me. But then other times like this, I'm like, okay. And we caught it far, far in advance. But I was like, what is this? And they're like, oh yeah, that's a huge pension. I'm going to get half of that, right? And I was like, does anybody know that it exists? Oh, well, I assume they do. Yeah, of course. I'm like, I don't see it anywhere. And they're like, you know, so I think that that's part of the role of the expert as well, is we can't assume that the attorney has seen everything. We can't assume that the attorney sees it through our eyes, right? I mean, you are very sophisticated and have a lot of credentials and a lot of background in this, but not everybody does. And so that's where I think it gets interesting to maybe give some advice to basic things that the expert should keep in mind if they're inexperienced, and inexperienced in general, but then that will lead them to, if they're inexperienced in depositions, it also kind of creates a unique point of help that they might need.
That's a great question. And I like to work with young forensic accountants or inexperienced forensic accountants with this. Number one, judgment is your friend. When you don't know how to answer a question, so that's my judgment. And I said, well, you haven't been an expert for very long. You've only got your credentials in the last year or two. So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about my judgment, which is experience, training, and education throughout my entire career. Going back to college, master's degree, working on the audits, and occasionally dipping my toe in the tax department when they need some help. So the judgment that comes through in learning the basic terminology to survive a deposition as an expert takes practice. Okay. And there are some great schools out there that are taught by some fabulous forensic accountants out there to really help. But know that professional judgment is a great place to run and hide if need be. Now, even if you're stuck in a beauty contest and you've been a CFF for 2 years, you've done two depositions, no testifying in court, and you're up against a behemoth forensic accountant who's testified over 100 times in the courtroom, done over 300 depositions, spoken at every conference, with a half ounce of confidence, you're going to do just fine. Okay. Now, what they're going to do is try to lay some basic traps for you. And in my book, I kind of cover some of those. But at the end of the day, you should always be very, very comfortable with your own skin and understand that those traps are there and that you must stay calm. And if somebody's yelling at you, leave. Okay. Punt. Get out of there. Mm-hmm. And then because nobody needs to be yelled at. And I do know forensic accountants that have been yelled at by divorce attorneys. And the reason the divorce attorneys yell at them is because they don't have anywhere else to go other than to bully them. And so it's a lot of fun, your first few depositions. And if you need to know what some of those likely questions are, I wrote a book, and in the back I've got many, many, many pages of sample questions. And so you don't have to be perfect, you just need to not stand on a landmine or step on a landmine and have that blow up. Another thing is methodology. How did you come about figuring out what you're going to do on this engagement? Start with, I used my education, training, and experience. I looked at the basic documents and went through and chose some techniques to go through. Well, what do you mean by techniques? Well, the work I do is a technique. So I'm comparing a tax return to a financial statement. I'm comparing the financial statement from the business to a financial statement given to a credit facility. They're going to look, they look a little bit different. I want to know what those differences are. I want to look at the general ledger. Are there a bunch of complex transactions going on in retained earnings? If so, I'm going to, I did. I found a few. They were adjusting entries. And I got the supporting documents I need, blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of great opportunities if you learn the basic craft as a young, inexperienced or young or inexperienced, because there's plenty of forensic accountants out there in their 50s that left audit and tax because they thought it would be fun. And it is fun. Mm-hmm. It really is. And I get real excited about going to the CPA conferences and look around the room. And now there's people there way younger than me. Used to be the other way around. So, you know, it's exciting. It's fun. But you do need to make sure that some of the obvious pitfalls are avoided.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that people, I encourage attorneys to do is to reach out to their own expert and ask for questions for when they go to depose them. Now, from the expert's point of view, they have to understand that a deposition is like a very calm and casual way sometimes for the attorney to get everything out of your brain. And do not fall for it. Because, you know, the attorney will come off very nice and like, oh, I just want to understand what you did here. And you'll get in this comfortable position of talking too much. And I think that that's can also affect them. Or being very, you sort of have to be listening to the questions to try to gauge like, okay, what path are they going down? Because I don't want to get caught in the path. But I'm trying to figure out like, what is that? And because so most of the time after the deposition, I'm briefing with the attorney and they're saying, okay, I heard the line of questioning too, but like, where do you think they're going with it? And I might say, oh, okay, well, I know there's three areas that they're going to try to go after me in trial. Here's the three areas. Here's what they didn't ask. Here's what they don't understand, right? Because I don't have to, I'm not there to make anybody know everything at the deposition. I'm just there to answer the questions. And if you don't ask it and you don't get to the real heart of the matter, it's not really my problem, right?
Well, and that's one of the things I do talk about in my book is that it may be your goal, all right? Now, we have a superstar forensic accountant in my neighborhood, and he's testified 200 times in court. And I know, because we've done a lot of seminars together, nationally and locally and regionally, that he's bulletproof, okay? So I, in that case, if I trust my expert, what I want my expert to do is dominate the deposition. I want that expert to go down every rabbit hole and leave the opposing counsel with nothing. Mm-hmm. I could settle that case. Yeah. So it depends on what the objective is going into the deposition. Now, I would prefer that my forensic expert listen to me, because the old school way of handling the deposition is if somebody asks whether you have the time, some forensic experts will say, well, yeah, it's 10 till 3. What they should say is, I don't know. Do you have a watch? Yes, I do. Would you look at your watch? Why do you need me to look at my watch? It's outside the scope of the deposition. Okay. So there's a number of ways to stonewall opposing counsel. But sometimes those ways of stonewalling to protect your testimony doesn't result in a settlement.
Okay. Right.
So, but it is good old school technique. Mm-hmm. And sometimes can scare them even more. But I love forensic accounting. I love forensic experts. I want to dominate that aspect of the case. I want the opposing lawyer knowing I got him.
Yeah, and from an expert perspective, it is two different theories, right? Because one is you could have an attorney just answer the question and that's it. And what you're saying is also very prevalent, which is when I go in there, as an expert, I am going to clearly, you know, like if they're going down a path and I'm like, oh, I could let them go down the path. They think they know what they're talking about. I'm going to clearly go in and say, no, that is incorrect, or, you know, whatever the language is. But here is actually what the situation is. Because in my mind, at the end of the deposition, I want them to walk away with, I don't ever want to take her into court, right? I don't ever want to cross-examine her in court. I want to try to settle it. It also is if they got it wrong, you know, like, If they're going down a path that maybe somebody told them makes sense and they're going down, I would rather kind of fix that then, because we don't need to to kind of, you know, use it and save it till trial, right? A lot of people want to, let's save it to trial. There's no reason. Like, they should walk out of the deposition and really be like, well, yeah, I don't think we're going to go much further at this point.
Oh, one of my favorite tactics is during settlement negotiations, if we've already done a round of experts, just offer my expert for another depo. Mm-hmm. So if you're questioning this, depose him or her again. I don't care.
Right.
And you talk about negotiating from a position of strength at that point. It mm-hmm. really alters it, because I'm big on relative negotiating position. I want as much as I can have to shove my proposal and scare people into settling, because I love the courtroom. Don't get me wrong, but if I can get the settlement, why not?
Yeah. And a lot of times things will, I mean, deposition is a great discovery piece, you know, like we really are, the attorneys are trying to figure out, you know, did that expert consider A, B, and C? It doesn't seem like they did, but maybe they did. And they're also, from an attorney's perspective, they're asking questions so that they know the answer, so that when they go to court, they're going to kind of use that against you.
Absolutely. But there's going to be winners and losers in every case.
Yep.
As far as sub issues. Mm-hmm. And you take the hits on the ones you're going to have to take hits on, own them, mm-hmm. and do everything you can to keep your credibility or your client's credibility.
Well, and as an expert, there's a middle ground in depositions. There's mm-hmm. I can offer too little and I can offer too much, right? I can offer too little information. I just kind of, you know, yes, no, answer the questions, but I'm not really elaborating. You know, like sometimes you want to make them work hard, but sometimes if it's not really a path that's going to lead to fruition, but then there's talking too much, right? And you don't want to do that either. You know, so it's like, I need to give enough information to show that they're going down the wrong path, but not enough information to also guide them to where the real path is. You know, like, it's a beautiful little middle ground there, but it does take some experience, because if you're just getting started, that deposition is so stressful anyway. Like, you don't even know. And what do we do when we get stressed? We talk too much. It's just what we do.
Yes. And that's why I put together the checklist of questions that everybody should have in there. And the funny thing is the simple questions are the ones that always trip up young and inexperienced forensic accountants, because my favorite follow-up question of all time is why? Mm-hmm. I did A, B, and C. Well, why? Because that's what you do.
Yeah.
No, my experience, training, education told me I need to compare this and this to start. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And then what'd you do? They're going to have an answer for what they did, but then the why. And mm-hmm. that is there are a few accountants out there that teach methodology. And I would encourage going to see them and sit in those classes. And if you can explain the methodology, you can explain the techniques you employed, you're almost bulletproof at that point because you're not looking for fraud. Mm-hmm. Now, if you run across it and you trip over it, that's something else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so my favorite thing for the young or inexperienced forensic, how many seminars have you taught? None. Well, that's okay. But they feel bad emotionally, you know. How many articles have you written about forensic accounting and published in journals, whether legal or accounting? None. Well, they're just out of school, so I can load up a bunch of questions like that. But they got to know that that's coming, expect it, live with it, and own it. And they'll be fine, because the big thing is they got those three letters past their name, CPA or CFF or both. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, as far as business valuation credentials, there's several to choose from. But the point is, having or not having the core credentials for something isn't something judges wake up and worry about. Mm-hmm. They're going to judge your credibility based on how you answer the question more than what the answer is.
Well, and even some of those answers, I know as I was asked one of those recently in a deposition or trial, and they asked about like what I had authored. And I was like, well, what do you mean what I authored? Like, we produce, you know, anywhere from 10 to 50 pieces of content every month, and we put it on a multitude of platforms. Would you like videos? Would you like interviews? Would you like, and they were like, I think I'm just going to go to the next question. And I was like, that's fine. But let's be clear. Like, do you want blogs? Because it's not with technology, it's not so much all of those things. It's a bunch of stuff. And so, you know.
Yeah. What I would also encourage some forensic accountants to do is publish in legal journals.
Absolutely.
That the judges know. And all you have to do is go to my bio and look, and I've published pretty regularly. But those articles started out as content for my blog. Mm-hmm. And I liked how they were coming out. And I paid a person to edit them for me, clean them up, mm-hmm. and submitted them. And I've been very successful publishing. And so several of the forensic accountants I've worked with over the years have published, Tennessee Bar Journal. I'm mm-hmm. sure Missouri's got the Missouri Bar Journal. So I would encourage you to take some of those, pay somebody to an editor, clean it up a little bit, and make sure the grammar's right and the citations are correct, and submit them for publication. Yeah. Why not? It's not that hard. And then you got webinars for ASCPA, and you got webinars for ABA Family Law Section.
Yeah,
much less AAML. There's just a lot of great outlets out there for forensic accountants to take the material they already have, and it doesn't have to be unique.
Right,
One of the things you may find interesting is one of the most popular seminars in the history of the ABA Family Law Section is how to read a tax return.
But I think that that's because I know that that's true, because I do that same proposal with law firms all the time. And I'm just like, listen, I know you're going to already look at the tax returns. Why don't you just have like a nice little cheat sheet of looking for certain items? And if certain items show up and they're big dollar numbers, they're going to impact the valuation or they're going to impact the financials, and you need to get an expert involved. Because a lot of times the attorneys are not trying to do the job of the expert sometimes, but not really. Most of the time, they're just trying to identify, do I need to pull in that expert? And when do I do it? You know, like, it, can we settle it without the person? You know, what are the fees? But I also encourage people to work with business valuation and other experts kind of in a different capacity and start with just, you know, can you take a certain number of hours and just look and see what we have? You know, where should we focus? Is there a focus? Is there not? And you're kind of scoping it out at the beginning, but I think it's a lot easier to sell that quick process, you know, and then you can kind of walk with them. Because there's many times where I'll tell the client, I'm like, you know, we've looked at everything. You know, we still need to finish out the year. Like right now, you know, everybody's getting their 2020 information done, right? Let's just pause because we don't need to do a bunch of stuff. We need to do it in chunks so that it's more efficient. And then when we get the information, then we'll look at it, you know? So I think there's ways to make it more cost effective. But you also need to, you know, work with the experts that work in that position.
Yeah, my favorite when I'm talking to lawyers is I love to ask questions. And I say, what's an attachment to a tax return? Where is it located? And what's a schedule? And what does that mean? And lawyers' eyes glaze over. And if I were a forensic accountant, I'd say, well, I do know the difference. There are some attachments that are included with the return because they're required. There are some attachments that are included with the tax return that are not required. There are attachments that you save at your office in the event of an audit. And then there are some attachments that you may not want to keep.
Right, right.
So there's a whole much less schedule as well. Schedule A, well, that is a schedule, yes, but that's not the asset depreciation schedule from 10 years ago that you need to take a look at, even though all the assets are fully depreciated.
Yeah.
What? They just glaze over. So that's what I love about helping forensic accountants. And of course, I get nothing in return from the professionals. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun stuff.
Well, hopefully we kind of touched on a whole bunch of different areas that the Forensic Accounting Desk Book talks about. And you even say a practical guide to financial investigation and analysis for family lawyers. That's what it looks like. Yay. So it's a very cool book. I think that, you know, attorneys reach out to me all the time, kind of wanting a guide to valuations or the financial aspects of divorce. And I think that there are several out there, but this is very helpful specifically for divorce. And I think that when we're looking for information, it really is helpful that it's, you know, because you can write a lot of different information about how to deal with this in other capacities, and it's just not going to be applicable in a divorce setting. So please reach out and purchase that book. But also, if they wanted to read, you have an amazing website. You have a ton of information. I think that anybody starting out or even experienced in this field could reach out and look at your website and get a ton of information, just a different perspective, I think.
You're very kind.
But thank you so much. And we'll probably have you back again to talk about some other fascinating topic in divorce, right?
Yes.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.